February 10th, 2015. Good morning, members. Welcome to the commissioner and to the department. This morning, we're going to have the department present the energy production study that we requested of them from last year. We had some issues revolving around whether we were going to expand production taxes onto solar in lieu of other types of property taxes. Had some conversations about the wind production tax and asked for more information on a broader scale of energy production in Minnesota from the department. So they've been working through the interim and are here this morning. So welcome, Commissioner Bowerly, and whoever else you would ask to join you at the table. Commissioner Bowerly, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Bowerly, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. Good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to present this work on the Department of Revenue. We did engage in this study at your request last year, and it was a robust process throughout the summer and fall and into the winter. I want to thank, in particular, the Department of Revenue team who worked on this. You'll hear from several of them today. Nathan Jessen, Andrea Fish, Eric Willett will present to you, and there were many others working on this at the department. I also sincerely want to thank the stakeholders who worked with us to gather information, respond to surveys, and provide their input at meetings and other methods of providing information to us from both host communities and from the industry. And I know you'll also be hearing from some of them today. So we greatly appreciate their work with us in producing this report. We look forward to working with you on any follow-up to this report as you consider how to move this important issue forward for Minnesotans. So I will turn it over to the experts now, and we are happy to provide this information to you and answer any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Commissioner, I did have the opportunity to attend one of the meetings at the department. It was well attended. There was very good dialogue. So I, too, am looking forward to hearing the balance of the report from Mr. Ouellette and Mr. Jensen and Ms. Fish.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Nathan Jessen. I'm a tax policy research specialist at the Department of Revenue. Last legislative session, the department was tasked with creating a report outlining the taxation of electric energy producing systems in Minnesota. The report was to evaluate the various energy producing systems, including both traditional and renewable energy sources, and also examine available exclusions, exemptions, payment in lieu of taxation that applied to the different systems. The report was to evaluate the property taxes per unit of energy produced in Minnesota compared to border states, alternative tax or fee systems for compensating host communities for the costs imposed by these energy facilities, as well as make recommendations for the taxation of solar energy producing systems, especially bearing in mind the solar energy production tax passed last session. To achieve these outcomes, Revenue conducted research on the taxation of energy systems, conferred with a working group of industry members, which included city officials, industry officials, and legislative staff. We surveyed host jurisdictions. Before we surveyed these host jurisdictions and utilities, we also got input from utilities and cities on what the right questions were to ask, what they thought would be relevant. We discussed taxation with neighboring states, particularly just those border states. On October 23rd, we sent a team to tour a solar facility in Collegeville, Minnesota. We also had a couple of legislative staffers and members of the industry there to learn more about how these solar facilities worked, the scope of them, and what kind of costs they can impose on communities. We also hosted meetings on October 31st and November 21st with these utilities, host communities, and legislative staff. To get feedback on the survey, we discussed preliminary results with them to see if they thought there were any gaps in the information we'd acquired. And on November 21st, we discussed possible recommendations they may make given the preliminary results we shared with them. as well as trying to address any concerns they may have had about the results we'd had thus far. With that, I'll turn it over to our Director of Property Tax Research, Eric Ouellette.
Thank you, Mr. Jessen. Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Ouellette. I'm with the Department of Revenue, and with me is Andrea Fish from the department. I'm going to first go over in a real high level of some of our key findings, and then we'll circle back and get into a little bit more detail. So one of the biggest challenges with this report was that many of the costs and benefits of hosting a electric generating facility are not quantifiable. So we were able to identify some of the significant costs and benefits, but not able to quantify them for different jurisdictions. Another challenge is that a value-based property tax system that we have, which has exemptions, exclusions, and production tax elements, provides various levels of compensation to host communities. There really is different treatment of different facilities in our system. We were unable to conclude one way or the other whether the property tax system accurately accounts for the unique and varying burdens imposed on host communities or whether it adequately compensates for current burdens. However, the property tax system does not generally account for potential long-term costs of hosting these facilities. Another important finding is that many of the host jurisdictions are very reliant on the compensation from facilities. In many cases, these facilities are the largest share of their tax base, and that these taxes have been unstable over time. We looked at the various tax approaches in neighboring states and in Minnesota and identified that they all have positive and negative aspects. We also concluded that the 2014 solar energy legislation is the best option for taxation of solar energy systems. We did meet with some limitations where we didn't get the research as far as we had hoped. We were unable to fully compare the taxation of energy-producing facilities in neighboring states. We got some information, but it was not robust enough to draw conclusions. We were unable to gather greater detail and additional data on other industrial facilities, that is, how energy-producing facilities compare to other industrial facilities. And we did not identify other non-property tax mechanisms for addressing the concerns of the host communities. For most of our work, we stayed within the property tax system. With that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Fish.
Thank you, Mr. Ouellette. Ms. Fish.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Fish. I'm also with the Property Tax Division of the Department of Revenue. As Mr. Ouellette stated, one of the key findings was that it is inconclusive whether the property tax system accurately accounts for the unique and varying burdens imposed on host communities. Accuracy of a value-based property tax system is examined by comparing the level to which taxes of similar facilities account for the burdens imposed on host communities by those facilities. Within a perfectly accurate system, host communities would receive property tax income from their energy-producing facilities. That property tax income would parallel the costs of hosting the different facilities, and property taxes received would vary based on the different facility types and their respective differing costs. In reality, what we found was that the taxes paid by energy-producing facilities vary based on the fuel type, the ownership structure, and whether a given facility qualifies for other special exemptions or exclusions. This table summarizes the tax treatment of the various energy-producing facilities. You can see that depending on the fuel source or type of facility, they may pay real and or personal property tax or production taxes. What this shows is that it's not necessarily accurate based on the cost of hosting a given facility. For example, we know that other non-energy industrial facilities do impose costs on their host communities, but most industrial facilities are not subject to personal property tax, as many of our utility facilities are.
What this means is that the policies we have in place is that the taxes paid per kilowatt hour of production can vary based on the facility type and the fuel type. It's difficult to draw a correlation between the amount or type of energy produced and the taxes that are paid by the producing facility. As you can see, biomass and hydroelectric pay some of the higher taxes per kilowatt hour, while coal and wind have the lowest. In fact, of the traditional fuel types, coal energy producing facilities do have the lowest taxes per kilowatt hour. This is an interesting comparison between the two because wind and coal certainly have varying degrees of costs and benefits for their host communities, and yet they pay the lowest taxes. And this is in part because of some of the other mechanisms we have in our property tax system. Pollution control exemption is a great example of that. A lot of the coal facilities qualify for pollution control exemptions, which reduces the burden that they would be paying within their host community. There are also personal property exemptions on specific identified facilities, as well as a sliding scale market value exclusion that applies to certain properties based on the efficiency of their production. With that, I will turn it back over to Mr. Ouellette to discuss the adequacy.
The second lens we looked at this taxation through, Mr. Chair, is whether the revenues that are generated by these facilities for the host communities are adequate given the burdens that they produced. As I mentioned at the outset, we couldn't quantify all the costs, so it's not a simple yes or no answer, but we were able to do some identifying of the costs and benefits. So if we had a perfectly adequate system, the property taxes a host community receives would sufficiently cover the costs imposed by its energy-producing facility. But as I mentioned, we're not able to quantify all those costs. Let me talk a little bit about the various benefits and costs. We conducted a survey of host jurisdictions and energy companies, as Mr. Jessen noted, and some of the benefits that were most frequently cited were highly skilled jobs, ancillary economic benefits of having these facilities, and the corporate citizenship of the utility companies and the good works that they do within the community. There were additional benefits identified that were identified as being unique to the energy-producing industry. So these are ones that were identified through the survey as being something that only energy-producing facilities bring to the community. And these include a stable source of electricity, lower-cost utilities, higher tax base due to the personal property taxation that Ms. Fish mentioned, and the environmental benefits of mandated buffer areas. On the cost side, the main costs that were identified were pollution, development and land use limitations, the need for additional emergency equipment, and the storage of waste or byproducts. Some of the companies that answered the survey pointed out, however, that they the efforts that they've undertaken to reduce some of these costs in terms of additional pollution control and some reimbursement to local governments for some of the public safety costs. There were additional costs identified that were identified as being unique to the energy-producing facilities. And these include long-term costs of cleanup and land reclamation, special public safety and emergency response costs, the potential for catastrophic incidents, and land and development restrictions that are unique to these facilities. The costs and benefits that were identified varied based on whether the respondent what energy source they represented, or the size of the facility, or the ownership structure of the facility. For example, respondents in communities with coal facilities were more likely to mention job creation, highly skilled workforce, and diversification of the tax base and lower taxes as benefits. Whereas for nuclear facility hosts, they were more likely to identify development and land use regulations and negative public perceptions and legacy issues with having the nuclear plants in their community, as well as a deterrent to attracting businesses. In terms of ownership structure, I'm sorry, in terms of facility size, the larger facilities were more likely to identify a broader menu of costs and benefits than the smaller facilities that may not have as high of a profile within the community. Finally, in terms of ownership structure, municipal utilities which do not pay property taxes, they were more likely to identify a lower cost utilities as the main benefit of having the municipal utilities in their community. This graph shows the public utility property taxes as a share of total taxes over time. This particular graph includes utility property beyond just electric generation. It also includes pipelines and electric distribution and transmission lines. But what it shows is a steady trend of decline over the last several decades in the share of taxes paid by utility companies. And this is mainly due to a couple of factors, one of which is the faster growth in property values in homestead and agricultural land, growing faster than utility values, cause utilities to be a smaller share of the total tax base. Additionally, there have been some significant state policy changes that have impacted the share of the utility taxes.
Mr. Ouellette, with the state policy changes, would that be the accelerated depreciation schedules?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I was just about to get to that.
Ouellette.
Yep. Not only has the state policy changes impacted the total amount of utility taxes, it also has caused some instability in the reliability of the taxes paid by utility companies. And the two main causes of this over the last several decades has been the compression of property tax classification rates that was happening throughout the 1990s and culminated in the 2001 property tax reforms, and also the 2007 utility valuation rule change that the department undertook, which also caused utility values to be reduced by as much as a third. We did look a little bit at the tax and fee systems to compensate host jurisdictions. We did not come up with any specific recommendations for changing the existing mechanisms for compensating local taxing jurisdictions, and that is primarily due to the fact that so many of the costs and benefits are not quantifiable that it was difficult to ascertain what would potentially be the most fair alternative to the current system. And we'll talk about some of the pros and cons of alternative approaches in a few minutes. As I said, many of the cost benefits are not quantifiable, and because of that, it's difficult to draw a correlation between what the appropriate amount of tax would be for a particular host jurisdiction and what the costs are that their jurisdiction faces for hosting the facilities. We did want to make sure to point out that for many host communities, the utility property taxes are a significant portion of their tax base. This chart shows six of the communities in Minnesota that have the heaviest reliance on utility property taxes. The first column shows what all the utility property is as a percent of the market value within their community. The city of Becker, it's 66% of all the market value in the city is utility property. The second column on the right shows what share of the tax base is from the personal property, which is unique to the energy-producing industry. And for Becker, that's 49% of their tax base is in the value of the personal property that's taxable within the city of Becker. And you can see the other cities there in the chart. Statewide, most communities don't have a lot of utility value other than some transmission distribution lines, so the statewide averages are rather modest. But for the communities that host the very large facilities, the facilities are a very important component of their local tax base. And with that, I'll turn it back to Ms. Fish.
Ms. Fish.
We did, as part of the study, again, look at not only Minnesota's mechanisms for compensating host jurisdictions, but our neighboring states as well. We used typical tax principles when examining the mechanisms that are used in the neighboring states. to determine whether these systems had positive or negative attributes. Some of the main principles that we looked into were understandability of the system, efficiency of the system, stability for the host communities in terms of tax revenue, and responsiveness to changes. For this one, we looked at responsiveness to changes in production at a given facility. Each system that we looked at has its own positive and negative attributes, and certainly trade-offs. One of the biggest ones we saw was the trade-off between stability for the host community and responsiveness for the producing facility. Value-based taxes is part of the property tax system, not just in Minnesota, but also Iowa, Michigan, North Dakota, and South Dakota. In each state, it might be applied to real and/or personal property. Value-based taxes are a more stable source of taxes for the host community, but they are less responsive to production changes at the facilities. They're more complicated and difficult to understand, as I know many in this room appreciate. And because of that complication, they can be more expensive to administer due to the complications. Production taxes that we have in Minnesota on wind and solar facilities, and that we've also seen in wind energy facilities in North Dakota and South Dakota, are more efficient to administer. They're also simpler to calculate and more responsive to changes in the facility's use. They're also more understandable to taxpayers. They do allow the facility more control over their taxes by modifying their production output. But it was inconclusive that production taxes would be a stable source of taxes for a host community. Capacity taxes, which is part of the overall mechanism in North Dakota, are based on a facility's energy capacity, that is, its ability to produce energy and not necessarily the energy that it's produced. Because of this, it's more stable than production taxes, and it's easier to understand. But again, it's not responsive to changes in a given facility's energy output.
Ms. Fish, while we're at this point in your presentation, would you want to talk about the finding that the production tax that was implemented last year for solar was actually the best tax that you thought? I think that's one of your conclusions, and maybe this would be a time to talk about that briefly, or do you have that later on?
Mr. Chair, that's coming up in just a couple slides.
Okay.
Yeah. As Mr. Ouellet noted, one of the limitations was that we were not able to fully vet non-property tax mechanisms for funding host communities. Iowa has an example with an excise tax on some of their energy-producing facilities. These are applied to transactions normally at a wholesale level. So these can be responsive to changes in the industry, maybe administratively efficient, but because it's not a property tax, it was difficult to ascertain how that worked for host communities. And Wisconsin, in fact, does not have a tax system for their energy facilities, but has a licensing mechanism in order to gain revenue. Mr. Chair, we did look into the taxation of solar energy producing systems, and we did determine that the 2014 legislation was the best option for taxation of solar energy producing systems. There were three major components of last year's changes. The first was clarifying that the solar energy generating systems are exempt. This was broader than what had been in statute prior to last year's change, which was just for the photovoltaic devices. This is consistent with general exemptions. For example, wind energy production systems are exempt from taxes. Secondly, the legislature created a solar energy production tax. As we discussed, production taxes are understandable, simple and efficient, and responsive to changes in energy produced. Additionally, and importantly, it mirrors the taxation of wind energy systems, another renewable energy source that we have here in Minnesota. It's also easier for companies to understand and to comply with. Finally, last year's changes clarified the classification of property that's primarily used for solar energy production, allowing assessors to identify that if solar energy generation is the primary use of a property, that its classification should be as industrial property, whereas if there's a solar panel that's a secondary use of the property and, say, the overall use is for a farm, it might be able to retain its classification that way. So the major recommendations we had as part of this report were certainly to maintain the solar energy production tax that was enacted last year along with the other solar energy legislation. We also noticed that there is one additional modification that could be made to the wind energy production tax to make it more consistent with solar energy production, specifically updating the criteria for combining the nameplate capacity. This is just a way that we could value those wind energy conversion systems based on the actual value of the entire system. Right now, in the current way the legislation is written, it's possible for a wind energy company to build more conversion systems within a few days apart, but keep a lower tax rate just based on the way the law is written. And finally, maintaining a property tax classification system that's reflective of property primarily used for energy generation. In closing, we would certainly like to thank you for the opportunity to have undertaken this study. We give our sincere thanks to the other members of our division who helped us, the industry experts who worked with us, and the host communities who provided very valuable insight. So if you have any questions, we're certainly available to address them. Thank you.
Thank you. And maybe before we leave this recommendation page, you are recommending that the solar energy production tax be maintained, and I think from what I heard, reflective of, I don't know how we ascertain if it's reflected of the community costs or not, because as you indicated, they're hard to maintain or understand. But you do recommend that we maintain a property tax classification. It's just that the production tax for solar and wind is the best mechanism to tax that classification. Is that what your recommendation is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to clarify. The legislation that was passed last year allows for a property with a large solar energy generating system that pays the solar energy production tax to be classified as an industrial property. Whereas if that's a secondary use of the property, if it's a smaller solar energy generating unit that's not paying the production tax, the classification would be based on the overall use of the property as if the system weren't there. So it's more related specifically to the classification rather than the type of production necessarily.
Okay, thank you. Senator Rest?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a really interesting report, and thank you very much for your hard work on it. I regret that there's not better ways to measure the costs and the benefits to the local community. And I was wondering, is there could you identify some sort of set of data points that if we did have the information, we could come to more clarity on those questions? And what would that set of data points look like if we had the technology, if you will, to actually identify them without being, an overburden on either the companies themselves and their employees and or the host communities? What would that data consist of if we could actually get it? Do you understand what where I'm going? I mean, maybe, Mr. Chairman, 7 or 8 years down the line, there will be, we've developed this and that and the other thing, and we can measure these costs and these benefits, and we could come back to this kind of study if we thought that we could get more accurate results and maybe make some changes that would accurately that would provide accuracy in balancing benefits and costs, because I think you would have gone there if it had been not just readily available but available at all.
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a couple of them that would be probably the biggest challenges and hurdles would be how do you assign an economic value to the cost of higher pollution in your community? You know, what is the cost to the resident of one of these communities versus another community of potentially being exposed to higher pollution? And another one, which would probably be even more challenging for an economist, would be the psychological toil of the potential for a catastrophic incident, or the concern of living near a facility that might have a significant occurrence at it. I think those are the two that we kind of discussed a little bit, but felt were well beyond our wheelhouse.
Senator Russ.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we know the department doesn't deal in emotions. However, statistics on health conditions and whether there is a higher incidence of with regard to air pollution of COPD or emphysema or lung cancer or, you know, heart attacks or strokes, that you might not be able to isolate those factors directly relating them to the facility, but if there were higher incidences of those factors than in host communities that didn't have them, that were otherwise everything had been controlled for, that could you could get eventually sophisticated enough data to say, yeah, this facility, you know what, it doesn't have any effect on the health conditions of the people in this community at all, and they should feel relieved and satisfied that there is benefit without a burdensome cost, or the other way around. But let's just take the positive. So,
Senator Rest, I think. And maybe the department can respond to this, too. But to your point, I think we might just as well get to it. You know, one of the reasons that we started this study was because we are making decisions that are impacting communities and making value decisions. And we have this system in place. Clearly, if you look at the data, it doesn't reflective at all of what – I mean, there's been no master plan. It's just kind of what has happened. And so – when we look at this report and we look at what, you know, I think we should be looking at is exactly where you headed. Maybe there are other mechanisms that are better that will be more reflective of the host community's costs. Maybe they would be a better mechanism for the industry in order to have long-term stability to what they think their taxes are going to be. You know, these things are unstable and they have changes. And so part of where I was going to head with this conversation and hopefully this report is we look at what other communities are doing. The solar is production tax is the best for solar. Is that something that we could contemplate expanding beyond just wind and solar? Should we contemplate a capacity tax? Should we contemplate a generation tax?
We have this tension between capacity and an output. And, you know, they said that a number of the communities didn't respond because they have smaller facilities and probably just too much to go into all the detail that you were probably asking for. And, you know, what's the difference in a community but of having a peaking facility, for example, that's not run very often, and we shouldn't consider that it's going to have, and it's just common sense, not anything more than that. It's not going to have, one would think, the impact on the community in terms of costs and benefits, this intermittent running facility, that something that runs 24/7, 365. I mean, that's a common sense thing, but we don't have the data to substantiate what the common sense conclusion would be.
And maybe if it'd be okay, Senator Rest, let's narrow this question up to just focus on the exclusions that currently we have in place. And peaking plants, I think 20 some of them have a complete exclusion. There are 15% of the value for nuclear is excluded from some mechanism. Significant percentage of the biomass plants is a pollution control exclusion. Could you get into a little more detail on some of these exclusions and some of the impacts and some of the rationales behind those, which, you know, might be a starting point for us to kind of as we contemplate this? Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair and members, there are three main mechanisms in the current law that reduce the taxable value of these energy-producing facilities. One is called the sliding scale exclusion, and as you mentioned, that applies to a broad array of facilities. And the just check my notes here. The other one is the pollution control exemption, which reduces the taxable value for some facilities that have put in special equipment to reduce the pollution output of that facility. And then the third one, as you mentioned, are special statutory exemptions where the legislature at a point in time decided that if a particular facility was built, it would be exempt from either personal property taxes or all property taxes. So that facility would pay little or no property tax compared to its peers. An important distinction between these, the pollution control exemption, the way energy companies are at least investor-owned and cooperative energy companies are valued on a unitary basis, which means the department values the entire value of the company and then spreads that value out to all the property that's owned by that company, including that outside of Minnesota and that inside of Minnesota. The pollution control exemption affects that overall Minnesota value. So the pollution control exemption has an impact not just where the equipment is, but on the value throughout the system, that company's system in Minnesota. The sliding scale exclusion, however, is applied to the equipment in the facility where that gets the exclusion. So that's a much more localized impact. And, of course, the statutory exemptions for a particular facility impact that facility in that location. So they have a different impact, even if the value were the same, they would have a different impact on the host community depending on which benefit they qualified for.
And, Mr. Weller, before I go on to ask about the impact on the overall tax, why do you use the unitary mechanism for valuation as opposed to just a regular value on those plants? And the reason I'm asking is I was at the meeting when this came up at the department, and this is causing a shift from what I understood between facilities in Minnesota that the host community actually has a property tax increase, but because you're reducing the value of the company overall, other communities would have a property tax reduction. And why do we use that mechanism?
Mr. Chair, I believe we're required to by statute and rule to do it that way. As you mentioned, the apportionment can have different impacts in different parts of Minnesota. However, generally speaking, the facilities that get the exclusion do get some benefit from it. It's sometimes in the other places where there can be either a positive or a negative impact, which is a little bit counterintuitive. But just based on the way the apportionment is weighted, and that's a pretty complicated formula that I won't attempt to verbally describe here. But I can provide in writing to the committee a description of how that works.
Okay. And then, Mr. Ouellette, on page 6 of the report is the table that has the tax paid, you know, with type of generation. I'm assuming because 64% of natural gas is an exempt, it's a pretty significant impact on that 0.0018. But can you talk about the other, if the exemptions weren't in place for, I mean, In the scheme of things, are these exemptions significant, or are they overall not significant?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the impacts are kind of scattered throughout the report when we talk about the individual fuel types. So I don't have handy a table that shows it, but they are very significant. For example, for coal, the impact of the pollution control exemption reduces it by almost over a third. So very significant reduction in value and taxes. Which fuel type is this? Okay. And then for natural gas, it's even more than that. It's more than half.
64%, I believe.
Yep. Yep. So these are very significant policy decisions that change the mix of how much taxes are paid by different facilities.
So, members, when we are contemplating this, there's significant impacts of things that somebody's had policy discussions about, and it's not uniformly spread across. Is it doing what we want it to do? I personally think I'd like to take a look at what other states are doing and if there aren't some other better mechanisms. Now, I know in your recommendations or your summary, you said that there just wasn't enough data available for that. But back to Senator Rest's question, what would have to happen in order for us to be able to move forward and contemplate some other mechanisms besides a good policy debate in the tax committee?
Mr. Chair and members, part of it is a policy decision on your part about which costs you think are appropriate to be compensated through property taxes. You know, pollution is one of the big ones. There are other industries that pollute that don't pay the same property taxes that these facilities do. So part of that is a decision on your part about what is appropriate for state policy to recognize as something that should be compensated through the property tax system. Beyond that, if health department experts could quantify differentials in health outcomes that were valid, I don't know if that's even feasible. But as Senator Ress said, then you could make some judgments about that.
And Mr. Ouellette, then take one more step so we can do some analysis on the short-term health impacts or not of a community hosting a facility. The one kind of large elephant in the room in the conversation I was involved in at DOR was the long-term costs of nuclear storage. Is there anything that you think the state might want to contemplate as it thinks about some of those costs? And I noticed throughout the report the current system doesn't do anything to assess those costs. And yet, do you have any thoughts on that as you did this study?
Mr. Chair and members, the federal law does do something to recognize those costs, and there is information in one of the appendices about that. But my understanding is that solution kind of assumes an eventual federal solution to the storage of the waste, and there's a lot of uncertainty around when and how that might happen. So. That could very well be something the state might want to address as some sort of identifying what the state's responsibility might be for that in the absence of a federal solution. But whether the property tax could play a role in that or not is unclear to me, because that's two very localized situations, and the property tax system we generally like to have addressing property broadly throughout the state. But that is something you could contemplate.
Senator Rest first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think for me, one of the attractive features of the solar energy production tax that we put into place is that indeed there is a rationale for it, and it is perhaps you have to determine primary and secondary use and that, but it's it is a process, an evaluation process that makes sense. What I get concerned about when we look at the history of the other facilities and tax types is that, and I don't mean to be necessarily a cynic, but, you know, I just wonder how arbitrary it was, whether it was just, okay, you want this, we want that, you know, split it in the middle, and there is no economic justification or science-based justification, and it was just, well, we have to tax them, so what's it going to be? Pick a number. You know, look at the top of a bus and pick the number off the bus, and that's what it's going to be. And so when we have this conversation, I think we need that caveat sitting out there rather than trying to back into what could possibly have been a policy-driven decision to at least acknowledge at some point that, well, maybe this one was kind of arbitrary, and we have to do better. And I'm not suggesting you start at ground zero, as it were, but that we keep that that kind of gnawing thing, a question about arbitrariness with regard to these things. And we know that happens in the class rate system. I mean, we adjust things based on the relative things. So if the homestead goes down, well, do we want to bring something else down as well without really examining the policy itself, but looking at proportionality. So, which is all, it's not a a bad tax policy principle, actually, but I do think we need to not assume that the taxation of these facilities came out of a purely policy-driven, and I don't mean to compare that with a political one, but a purely policy-driven discussion. So that's just my caution.
Well, and to a little further discussion on that same vein, and let's use the natural gas exemptions as an example. I think we would agree that if you were starting over, you wouldn't have 64% of them exempt and the other whatever not. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, since that's where we are today, we do have to have some concern about the shifting that's going to occur if we were to
make
changes.
If you make a change, right.
Senator Senjum, are you still on board? Senator Senjum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had some questions I was going to ask, but your comment a little earlier about the nuclear storage sort of prompted a little thought that kind of goes back home, and it comes from an individual that owns a fair number of wind turbines, and he's always suggesting to me, Dave, we need to have a public policy on how we close these things. You know, these turbines, in his mind, are going to be there long after he's gone. And he, by the way, has set up an ordinance in Dodge County to take care of these kind of things. But you know, could some part of this tax go to cleaning up, if you will, so to speak, 100-year wind turbines and solar farms and things like that, because all good things do come to an end. Technology will change, whether it's this or the Ford Motor Plant or whatever else. And you know, I'm just pondering now, but it is something to think about. Well, you've got 180, I think, cubic feet of concrete in the ground for a wind turbine, and that's a lot of concrete. Is that going to sit there forever, or are we going to take that out someday or whatever, you know?
Well, and let's turn that to department. Yeah. But there's actual examples of that today, because we have a power plant in Granite Falls that's not generating any electricity anymore, but it's on the property tax rolls, paying pretty much full bore property tax into that lowest that jurisdiction. Right. So what are we going to do with the wind turbines 100 years from now, but the plant in Granite Falls today? I mean, what do you have any thoughts on that? Mr. Willett.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe there's a step where a power plant closes and then it's officially decommissioned. And once it's actually decommissioned, it would be removed from the unitary value because it's no longer part of the system. So as long as that Grand Falls plant has the possibility of being fired back up again, it will stay on the tax rolls because it has the potential to produce energy. I may have gotten that wrong, but that's my understanding from the conversations we had.
Ms. Fish.
Mr. Chair and members, that's a good answer to it. It does get removed from the unitary value, so it changes the company's value within as the company as a whole and then what's attributed to Minnesota. But it is still on the property tax rolls because it is real estate, so part of that's taxable. With the wind energy conversion system, since they pay a production tax, when they're no longer producing energy, they would not be subject to the production tax, and they are exempt from personal property taxes on the conversion system. So between the energy types, there would be a different outcome when they stop producing. And that was one of the reasons that one of our findings was that we did not find the property tax system to adequately account for long-term costs. There's nothing within the existing mechanism that addresses what would happen when that production changes.
Anything else, members?
Mr. Chair,
Senator.
Just casually, I was wondering if the solar production tax, certainly okay, I can understand it would apply to a solar farm. What about an individual that has rooftop solar and he or she may use it in their home at some points of the day, but may put it out on the grid and sell it another time of the day? Is that person at that level taxed? Or subject to the production tax?
Ms. Fish.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sundjom, no, that would be a smaller production system. If it's producing under 5 megawatts, it's not subject to the production tax. And additionally, the primary use of the property would, if it's on a home, would still be a residential classification. And the actual system itself is exempt from taxation. So personal use solar energy systems are currently exempt from both real estate taxes and production taxes.
Mr. Chair, one more. And thank you very much. Did you look at municipal utilities at all? And although, for instance, in Rochester, we don't call it taxes, we call it payment in lieu of taxes. And my question would be that, generally speaking, do municipal utilities across the state, where they exist, have local payment in lieu of taxes, or is it vary city by city?
Mr. Willett.
Mr. Chair and members, we looked at that data a little bit, and many municipal utilities do make transfers to the cities on a regular basis, but not all of them do.
Okay.
We can get more detailed information.
Mr. Chair, I know at Rochester it's kind of a production task. It's based on the payment from the utility back to the city is based on the amount of power they sell.
Just a couple of narrower questions. So when we look at these exclusion or exemptions, do all of the facilities kind of have equal access to that, or what's the process for getting access to these special exclusions or these exemptions? Ms. Fish.
Mr. Chair, there is equal opportunity to the sliding scale market value exclusion pollution control exemptions for facilities that reduce pollution control or look into energy efficiency changes. Those primarily would affect the traditional fuel sources and not the renewables. Additionally, the personal property tax exemptions have historically been applied on a facility-by-facility basis, so they're narrowly construed for individual facilities.
And then on, I think it's on pages 38 and 39 of the report, there's a conversation about the external review of costs to these local communities that I found interesting, particularly that nuclear really had less of an impact or almost no impact on costs to the community and housing values, but coal had a pretty significant cost. Could you talk a little bit about some of the reasons you think that might have occurred, or if you have any thoughts on that? I think they're split between two pages, 38 and 39. Power plants moderately decrease housing values. Alternative energies and nuclear renewable have very small external costs. And then some of the talk, you have some conversations about energy production. production, increasing personal incomes. Do you have any thoughts about that? Any impact of these that would be helpful to us? Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair and members, that finding came from one of the studies that we reviewed as part of our research. It wasn't Minnesota specific. But that was just a study that had been done, and there should be a footnote to it somewhere that just showed based on their analysis, and I don't remember the methodology off the top of my head.
Okay. Anything else, members? I'm just kind of flipping through it here to see where my questions were. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along that same line on the cost for the hosting community, you mentioned that several reimburse local government for public safety. Could you give me an example of, do they have agreements? Do they just, out of the kindness of their heart, or how do they, and under what circumstances do they reimburse?
Mr. Lett.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dietzick, it may be good to have some of the industry people respond in more specificity, but what I remember from their comments were that they sometimes hosted some of the mandated training that is required by federal law and had agreements where they would assist in the purchase of some of the necessary equipment for fire suppression, for example. But those are the only specifics I remember. Do you have any?
Ms. Fish.
Mr. Chair and members, I also recall that there were different federal mandates for providing emergency equipment and training. I believe the information that we got that dealt with that most specifically came from Xcel Energy, and perhaps they would be better equipped to share that.
Anything else? And could you do one more thing before we adjourn? I think the questions are coming to an end.
Can we have testimony?
Oh, sure.
Three people testifying.
Sure. I didn't know there were, but that's fine. Yeah. Could you just give me a little bit more in detail about what's going on in North Dakota with their generation tax and the capacity tax that they have? Just a little more detail involved with that. Mm-hmm. Oh, lots of people. Oh, okay. Ms. Fish.
Mr. Chair and members, very generally, what we found in North Dakota is that the tax they have is based in part on capacity, meaning basically the facility size, and then also in part on production. So they had a combination of the two, the capacity size and the production output, to determine their tax amount for most of their facilities. Because of that, it's a little more complicated, but there's also some sense of stability in that it is based on capacity in large part, while also having a little bit of the responsiveness in terms of the generation and output component to it. That's the most general way I can describe that.
Well, and then I guess what my question is if the production tax is the best mechanism for solar, is not some of these other mechanisms going to be a better process for the rest of the energy production, electrical production in Minnesota that would be more reflective of the community costs? I know these are opinions and not necessarily something that you can put your, nail down firmly, but do you have any thoughts on that at all?
Mr. Chair, we did discuss that there were some trade-offs in costs and benefits or positives and negatives for each of the different tax types. So, again, whether North Dakota is more or less responsive than Minnesota's tax was very difficult to determine. Additionally, North Dakota doesn't have the same number and type of energy facilities as Minnesota. I believe they have one exempt hydroelectric dam. They have coal facilities and wind facilities, but they don't have as broad an array, so they aren't faced with the variance in costs to their host communities either.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Anything else, members? Thank you very much. Thank you. We'll look forward to continued conversation here. Mr. Peterson, Mr. O'Neill, and Mr. Evans. I guess there's three chairs. You might as well all come up. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bradley Peterson. I'm with the firm of Flaherty and Hood, representing today the Coalition of Utility Cities, which are Becker, Cohasset, Granite Falls, Hoyt Lakes, Monticello, Oak Park Heights, and Red Wing. Six of those seven were the cities that you saw on the chart who are most reliant on property taxes from the utilities that they host. And so we wanted to just briefly get on the record with a couple of things. The first thing I'd like to say is actually extend a lot of gratitude and thanks and commendation to the department for the process that they went through. I think all of our communities felt very comfortable with the process and its thoroughness and its inclusiveness. And we really appreciate their efforts and wanted to publicly thank them for that. A couple of other points that we'd like to highlight and basically really affirm some of the findings of the study, such as they are. You know, the study does suggest, and there are numerous benefits to the communities in terms of playing host to these large energy producing facilities. They do provide a lot in terms of tax base to our communities. They do attract a skilled workforce to our communities, and they are good corporate citizens. The study, however, also accurately does demonstrate some of the issues with hosting these facilities, and I think that the presentation that you saw did a good job of highlighting the instability in the property taxes that these communities are able to get from the facilities, and the decrease over time that we have seen with various policy and law changes that have occurred in terms of both the class rate compression that Mr. Ouellette mentioned as well as the valuation rule changes. Those have had a significant impact in terms of the valuation of the plants. And then finally, you know, the discussion about how do you determine what is the appropriate level of compensation for services is a vexing one. And I think as you saw, it is very difficult to draw a straight line between the property taxes that the utility pay to the services that they receive to the other benefits in the community. It is a very difficult thing to do. And one of the points that our communities that we represent, I think, did a very good job of is trying to highlight some of what we generally refer to as some of the intangible costs, the health concerns in the community, the perceptions of fear, both in terms of existing residents and businesses and potential businesses and residents when it comes to these facilities being the target of terrorism or some other catastrophic failure. Those are very real within these communities. And then, you know, there are, as you'll hear actually in Mr. O'Neill's testimony, several issues related to just the land use implications of having these facilities and having large solar installations, which is what he's going to speak about directly. You know, in the case of Granite Falls, while the property is not currently producing electricity, it is right on the Minnesota River. It does take up, you know, several acres of prime real estate, so to speak. And so there are, even aside from the production aspects, lots of land use implications with hosting these facilities. And I know in Becker and Monticello, we're talking, you know, dozens and up to hundreds of acres of property within these communities. And so there are some issues there. We did want to highlight, and I know it's important to Monticello and Red Wing to talk about the long-term costs of nuclear waste storage, that as you saw, Senator Scoy, in the meeting at the Department of Revenue, really is kind of one of these items that is in the room but not really well addressed by the property tax system, and especially given the current ambiguity with what's going on in federal law. And so with that, Mr. Chair, just really wanted to thank you, really wanted to affirm many of the findings of the study and thank the department for their good work. And then Mr. O'Neill has some comments about large solar installations, which actually all of our communities share the concerns that are happening in his part of the state right now.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any questions, members? Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. I'd like to concur with Bradley. The report was a good report. Department of Revenue did a great job of taking the input of the host communities into account in the report.
Mr. O'Neill, could you please state your name for the record to keep
track
of who you are?
Jeff O'Neill, City Administrator for the City of Monticello. Thank you. The report, however, the timing of the report came after some information that came to Monticello relating to a development of a relatively large solar facilities, so we're unable to provide that information on potential impact as part of this study. But given the opportunity to speak about that now, I thought I would take that opportunity to describe the situation in a little bit more detail. The legislative mandate in 2013 required 1.5% of our power to come from solar power. And according to statistics that we've heard, that resulted in 170,000 acres that needs to be set aside for this use. That's quite a bit of land. That's basically 28 square miles. And 28 square miles is one half the size of the city of St. Paul. That amount of land needs to be found for this solar power to be developed. And I think everyone in the state is excited about that prospect and want to see that that happens. But there are some trade-offs that have to occur with land use when this effort is undertaken, and I want to talk about that a little bit. Using Monticello as a little bit of a case example, because we have information right now today relating to a proposal. Presently before the city of Monticello is a proposal for a 400-acre solar field adjacent to the city limits in an area that has direct access to city utilities, an area that has been long planned for urban development for supporting a growing city in central Minnesota. Monticello is not against solar power by any means, but the city has invested heavily in utilities to serve this area in anticipation of urban development. And the city, county, and township have worked really hard to set that land aside for rural uses today so that in the future it could be developed wisely and efficiently with urban services. That area, of course, would be used for all of your urban uses, housing, job creation, shopping, and so on, developed in a compact fashion. When we compare the tax base of that 400 acres compared to the urban uses, we find that the urban uses to go there would generate 8.3 to 18 times the amount of tax base that a solar facility would provide on the edge of the community. And there are other revenue impacts in addition to taxes to consider here. Urban development, as it proceeds, is financed with fees that are paid by the area, the developers that are coming into the city. So as sewer, water, storm sewer are developed, you have to pay for those, and those charges are paid on an acreage basis. The cost for development spread to those developing areas is about $10,000 per acre. With a solar facility would not be expected to pay that because they're not using those services. Yet those costs for that 400 acres has to be spread to other property owners and to the city in general, which drives up the cost and eventually creates a kind of a financial bookend on any utilities going into that area. Finally, I guess, the fees and the tax generation is important. The other aspects of the economic impact relate to job creation and other opportunities within that growth area that would be stifled. The economic engine of that location adjacent to a freeway, adjacent to a city with services, that economic engine would be blunted with that size of a facility there. So I guess in summary, the Department of Revenue did not have information relating to these potential impacts as they developed their report, and the city, of course, did not have a chance to comment on them. So it's our view that the study could be benefited, or perhaps it needs to be extended to include these other issues that I've mentioned. So thanks for an opportunity to discuss this with you.
Sure. And Mr. O'Neill, just because I'm not real familiar with the geography around Monticello, but first of all, the 400 acres, is that in the city or outside the city?
It is actually directly adjacent to the city. It's in an area that we call the Monticello Orderly Annexation Area, and it's jointly governed from a land use planning standpoint by the county, the city, and the township to preserve it for urban uses in the future. So since the 1970s, the three entities have been working together to logically staged development over time. And ironically, by planning so well, having this land set aside for urban uses, it's opened the door to a solar facility that can be installed with the approval of the Public Utilities Commission, and no, the city and the county has no authority to stop it other than to provide comment to the PUC to see if we can encourage it to be located a little bit farther out. Again, Monticello, not against solar, just at that spot.
And just so we understand, I'm not, I mean, I would think that if the solar facility was looking for the most economical land to purchase, it would be a little farther away from the city, would be less valuable. And so why are, what's the draw to this parcel over one that's a mile away?
I'm not privy to all the finances relating to how these are located. However, the availability of such a large piece of land is a driving factor because they can aggregate all of that land to build a larger facility. That helps. It's also located to easy access to a substation and good access to the grid. So it could be pushed out slightly to, let's say, a mile, 2 miles from that current location. There would be a nominal cost, I believe, to move the connection point. But the value of the land at the location proposed is very similar to the value of the land within a mile, 2 miles of the city itself.
Okay, thank you.
If that helps.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. O'Neill, I understand the dilemma that you have here, and but I'm wondering about local zoning ordinances. Aren't there local zoning ordinances that could better protect your interests in this regard and protect against what you're talking about here?
Well, presently, according to the information that we've received, is that the Public Utilities Commission takes applications from developers for these facilities, and that the local governing authorities do not have direct authority in this regard. We can only comment to the PUC and comment on the application, so we have no guarantee that these would be these applications would be denied by the PUC.
Yep. Senator Nelson.
Just a follow-up. So I guess the question that I would have might not be one that you could answer, but I'd like to know, do zoning ordinances, can you zone the area? Like, what's the area zoned that you're talking about? What's the zoning on that area?
In our comprehensive plan as it comes in, it's a mixed-use type of zoning. It's but as far as the city itself has looked at the possibility of allowing solar fields in the community itself, in the city in particular. So it's our view that solar power does not fit an urban setting when it's of that magnitude. So, but unfortunately, because of the rules governing the siting of these facilities, in this case, neither the county, an orderly annexation area, or the city really has jurisdiction. It's the jurisdiction of the Public Utilities Commission to determine whether an application meets the standard of that mandate and whether or not it should be approved. So I can guarantee you that we will be looking and hoping for potential authority as a city or a county to possibly provide more direct input on the siting of these facilities. But again, this is very new to us. We've just found this out in the last 3 weeks. The application came through, and we're kind of struggling to understand how this will impact us and how we can try to work with the developer, try to work with the public utility. What do we need to do to get it in the location where it complements the community versus in direct conflict with our growth plans over time?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in this case, thank you, Mr. Chair. It just seems that it would be incumbent to understand the zonings for utilities, and I don't know what that is at this point, but to prevent problems like you're talking about or concerns, it just seems that it would be incumbent upon us to have a better understanding of zoning, and if utilities have a particular zoning requirement, and maybe that's a discussion for another day, but I think it is very relevant here.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. I had a thing I'd like to pass out if there's somebody can help me with that, or I can hand it to Senator Thompson.
We'll get a page.
Okay, thank you. First of all, Mr. Chair, let me join the other witnesses and testifiers in thanking the Department of Revenue for the manner in which they conducted their study and in their result. It was a very open process. They took input from all comers who came to give them some information, and I think in the process, in the discussions, everybody learned a lot. In my 13 years of lobbying for Xcel Energy, the bill that was passed by this committee last year and that was that brought this study about, you know, is the first time that we've looked at in this kind of depth at this issue, which has been troubling policymakers for all of those 13 years that I've been paying attention. So I think we're making tremendous progress on understanding the issues. I want to reiterate something that the chair said earlier about this, particularly this personal property tax, which is this was not created as some sort of reflection of the costs that are borne by a city or a county because a power plant is there. It just sort of happened, as the chair said. All companies used to pay personal property tax, and at some point it was repealed. I assume that the repeal was because there was fear of companies leaving the state and going to other states where they didn't have this tax. That concern, of course, didn't apply to utilities who find it difficult to pick up and move to other states, and so the concern didn't apply to us, and so we continue to pay the personal property tax. We're happy to do it, I guess, and we've never come in and asked for a repeal or a reduction in the property taxes. So what I wanted to point out with the chart, because I think it gives a good sort of illustration of the problem that our host cities have complained about with some justification, and that is the instability of this tax. What this chart shows, if you look at the lower line on the chart, that shows the real property tax that Xcel Energy has paid over this long period of time on the chart. The upper line shows the total tax. So the difference between the two lines is essentially the personal property tax. And you can see that compared to the relative stability of the real property tax, which I think is probably reflective of real property taxes across the state for all kinds of property, the personal property tax has varied tremendously. You can see some of the drops that were caused by the changes in public policy that have been referred to, and then you see toward the tail end some of the rather dramatic increases that result from, frankly, investments that we make in the plant of very expensive equipment that drives the personal property tax up. And so the utility, or rather the revenue of the city, is tied to depreciating assets and assets that also increase in value rather dramatically. I'll note that I joined the company in 2002 when we were on the tail end of the decline, so we were somewhat more defensive about the personal property taxes. But since that time, you know, I think we've shown that through the investment, we've increased the revenue we pay to our host communities, at least to some of our host communities. So this is provided really as an illustration of one of the problems that I think the cities have pointed out, which I think is a real concern, which is there's no real stability here. The last thing I will point out is I do appreciate the findings of the study that it's very difficult to attach burdens, particularly some of these, you know, really non-financial burdens that are placed on host communities. Let me add an additional complication to the issue that Senator Rest mentioned, you know, and that is that particularly power plants that emit, that pollute, are located in different places relative to the city that they're in, and the prevailing winds are different depending on where are different. And so the point is that the health impacts may not be localized to the city or even the county that the power plant is localized in. So if we're going to start looking at those kinds of burdens, it really is going to require a somewhat broader study. Most power plants are located on rivers, and rivers often are boundaries between counties. So, the actual location of the facility may not be the only consideration when you're looking at some of those burdens. So it is a significant issue to look at if we're going to start, you know, reviewing these taxes. And finally, let me just say that I think this was responsive to one of the issues that was raised earlier. For the nuclear plants, federal law requires us to have emergency plans filed and emergency agreements with cities. They don't necessarily have to be host cities. Sometimes we can have emergency agreements with fire departments or police departments in other locations if they happen to be handier or more easily reached. And under those agreements, we do compensate the cities separate from the personal property tax for the cost of some of those services. So those are subject to a separate agreement under state law, which is helping to implement the federal regulations that we're under. So that would be an additional thing to look at when you're considering, and that applies only to the nuclear plants. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. And could you add anything to the unitary valuation discussion that we had with the department? Do you have anything you'd like to add to that discussion we were?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I think the description of the unitary collection of this tax was correct or was accurate. I don't know why it is done that way, but I'll see if I can find out.
Okay. Senator Dietzick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, could you going back and talking about the emergency response, the additional payment, is that based on state law? And do you know, like, what statute if it is, or is it federal law?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, members, there is a federal regulation that requires us for our license to have these agreements. I believe, and I want to say Chapter 12 of state statute, I'm sorry I can't be more specific than that, does cover those agreements that are consistent with federal statute.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else? Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Evans, thank you for your testimony. Thank you all for testifying this morning. I just had a question about your chart. I think it says something other than what you may have said, and I want to understand your chart the way you mean to present it. Is the top line the combination of property and personal, real property and personal property taxes to demonstrate that when you add them together, it's very volatile compared to just the property taxes? Because it looks like it's a combined line, and when you mentioned it, I thought you were saying that it only represented the personal property taxes. So I want to make sure I understand this chart.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the top line is the total tax, including both real property and personal property. So the difference between the two lines, the space between the two lines, represents the personal property tax. And the point I was trying to make was that while the bottom line, while not exactly flat, is relatively flat compared to the top line, by that when you add in the personal property tax on top of it, you can see the volatility I was referring to.
Senator Ortman.
A follow-up. So then, Mr. Evans, when Xcel or other entities then invest in new equipment or expansion or upgrades, those personal property taxes go up. Am I reading it right?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. So if you look at the tail end of, you know, the chart from 2010 out through 2015, you know, we made significant investments in both the Prairie Island plant and the Monticello plant in order to get them relicensed. I believe there's also some fairly significant investments in the Sherco plant there. But I have to go back and check on the timing of that. But that's essentially what accounts for a fair amount of that increase that you're seeing there.
Senator Arnold.
Mr. Chair. Does Xcel and do these other entities, when they invest, also pay sales taxes on that equipment?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, I'm told that we do.
Mr. Chair, my comment would be that then it seems cost prohibitive to expand, to invest, to add new equipment. It becomes a huge burden when what we're trying to do is encourage those upgrades and encourage those investments. So I hope to learn a little bit more about the nature of that, the economic forces, and maybe you can provide a little more background for me on another occasion so that I can be more informed about how those investments have a positive impact, but they also have a very big cost for your investment.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Senator, let me just respond briefly. You know, because we are a regulated utility in the state of Minnesota, all of those investments are reviewed by the Public Utilities Commission and approved by them before we make them. So it's not quite equivalent to another private business deciding to invest or not invest. We have an obligation to serve our customers. We have an obligation to produce all of the energy that they require at any time. And that's why we go through the Public Utilities Commission process to approve each of these investments before we make them so that they can determine they're in the best interest of our customers in the state. So it's a little bit different than what you might be thinking in terms of another private business making investment.
Mr. Chair. And yet some are mandated as well. Right. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, that's also correct.
But on many of the mandated ones, they potentially receive the exemption for pollution control, because the pollution control would be mandated.
Thank you.
Senator Rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Ortman raised a really interesting point with regard to this high, this very sharp line in the last, in the last, what, 10 years or so. And, I mean, it would be very interesting to see, you know, calculations on the return on the investment, including the costs that come from the additional personal property taxes. Just like homeowners, you know, they have to weigh the costs of upgrading or making improvements in their properties, because the value is going to go up. They're going to likely pay increased property taxes for that, and the calculations that homeowners make, is it worth improving their property for in the long term or the short term or whatever? And maybe we're not particularly sophisticated in doing that, but I would think that XL is, and that would be you know, if there was no other factor, that's a very disturbing line. But I would hope that there's, you know, more complicated analysis relative to the investment that you're either mandated or that that you say, okay, well, we'll put this investment in and we're going to pay greater property taxes, but, you know, we're going to be able to deliver the energy more efficiently, and our bottom line is actually going to be okay. Or, you know, or we recover it through rate increases or whatever. So it's not an isolated phenomenon. Is that?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Evans.
Senator, you know, yes, let me make, I want to be very clear about this. I'm not presenting this chart to either complain about the investments that we made or to complain about the tax. We have never come in and asked for the personal property tax to be reduced. It's one of the costs. And frankly, we work through the Public Utilities Commission, and many of those costs are borne by our customers as they're passed through. The purpose of the illustration here is to show that this tax
volatility
is really volatile. And so I want to be certain you don't take away from my testimony that we're somehow complaining about that increase. From our point of view, you know, I suppose that increase is good news because it shows we're growing, it shows we're investing, and you're right, we earn a return on those investments.
And part of the volatility was a result of legislative and, you know, actions by the legislature and the governor, and they did rate compression. And if we went back to the report that DOR just presented, part of it was because of accelerated depreciation schedules. So there are other things going on in this line, particularly the downward part of the line, than just investments made by the company. So it shows the volatility, but there's other stuff going on in there.
Interesting.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Evans, we were talking earlier about Granite Falls and how when a plant is shut down but not totally decommissioned, it stays on the personal property tax stays on. My question relates to decommissioning of Monticello and Prairie Island, because I assume that's like 15, 20-year period of decommissioning. Will that be – do you know how that falls into the property tax? Is Red Wing, in effect, going to be – or Monticello, are they going to be – when does it fall off the personal property tax? When it's totally decommissioned or when it begins decommissioning? Because that's a huge chunk. It's a years off, but just curious how that plays out. Do you know?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Senator, you know, I'm going to see if I can defer to I'm getting a not sure, so I'm going to have to find that information and provide it to you. I will do so.
Yeah, we'll try to get that, Senator Marty. Anything else, members?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Sanger.
Thank you. And Mr. Evans, is it fair to say at the end of the day, you know, this chart reflects really what taxes your ratepayers pay ultimately? You pass these on, right?
Stroud.
I would expect you would.
Chair, Senator, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Anybody else wish to testify on the energy report? Seeing no one, any more questions? Commissioner Bowerly and DOR, thank you very much. Thank you for your work on this. It's been very helpful. We will have a continued discussion. I understand that DOR is in the process of collecting comments from interested groups, and that will be coming forthcoming to the committee and to the public. I don't know the time frame, but we'll try to get that out. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, just a comment that when Senator Coonan came in with the bill and you and Senator Rest decided to go ahead with this study, I think we got to do this. I mean, this is a perfect example of something that I don't think there was always well thought out policy in how we did it, and this shows how complicated it is to change it, but I think it's appropriate that we look at it. So thanks for requesting the study last year.
Thank you, Senator Marty. And to be honest with you, I'd like to move forward sooner rather than later. We'll see how kind of progress we can make. Nothing else on this. Thank you all very much. Thank you, Department. Division meeting tomorrow, Senator Rest?
8:30.
Full committee will meet next week. Thank you all very much. Seeing nothing else, committee is adjourned.